Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. First one-third of Part 2. Corrupt Head versus Natural Heart. Why do I feel so differently from the Reverend Dr. Price, and those of his lay flock who adopt the sentiments of his discourse? Simply because it is natural that I should. Because we are so made as to be affected at such spectacles with melancholy sentiments regarding the unstable condition of mortal prosperity and the tremendous uncertainty of human greatness. Because in those natural feelings we learn great lessons. Because in events like these our passions instruct our reason. Because when kings are hurled from their thrones by the supreme director of this great drama, and become the objects of insult to the base and of pity to the good, we behold disasters in the moral order of things. Some tears might be drawn from me, if such a spectacle were exhibited on the stage. But if I accepted the French revolutionaries' thoughts and feelings about human distress, I would think it was simply stupid to weep at distress shown on the stage. An arbitrary monarch. But the Reverend Pastor rejoices in this leading in triumph, because Louis XVI was an arbitrary monarch, which means neither more nor less than because he was Louis XVI, and because he had the misfortune to be born King of France, with the prerogatives that had been put in his possession by a long line of ancestors, and a long acquiescence of the people without any act of his. It has indeed turned out to be a misfortune for him that he was born King of France. But misfortune is not crime, nor is indiscretion always the greatest guilt. I shall never think that a prince whose whole reign involved a series of concessions to his subjects, who was willing to relax his authority, to give up his prerogatives, to call his people to a share of freedom that their ancestors had not known and perhaps had not desired, even if he had the common frailties attached to men and to princes, and even if he once thought he had to use force to fend off planned attacks on his person and the remnants of his authority, deserves the cruel and insulting triumph of Paris and of Dr. Price. I tremble for the cause of liberty when such an example is given to kings. I tremble for the cause of humanity in the unpunished outrages of the most wicked of mankind. If the King and Queen of France had been unbending and cruel tyrants, if they had schemed to massacre the National Assembly, I would think their captivity just. In that case, much more ought to have been done, though done in another manner. The punishment of real tyrants is a noble and awe-inspiring act of justice, and it has truly been said to be consolatory to the human mind. But if I were to punish a wicked king, I would have a concern for the dignity with which the crime was avenged. Justice is grave and decorous, and in its punishment seems to submit to a necessity rather than to make a choice. If the French king has in his own person and that of his queen really deserved these murderous attempts and those frequent indignities more cruel than murder, such a person would not deserve even the subordinate executive trust that I understand is to be placed in him, nor is he fit to be called chief in a nation that he has outraged and oppressed. A worse choice for such an office in a new commonwealth than that of a deposed tyrant could not possibly be made. To degrade and insult a man as the worst of criminals, and afterwards to trust him in your highest concerns as a faithful, honest, and zealous servant, is not consistent in reasoning, prudent in policy, or safe in practice. Those who could make such an appointment must be guilty of a more flagrant breach of trust than any they have yet committed against the people. I conclude that there is no basis for these horrid insinuations against the king. Speaking on behalf of England. In England we give no credit to them, and I think the honour of our nation is somewhat concerned in disclaiming the proceedings of this society of Old Jewry Street and the London Tavern. I have not been appointed to speak. I speak only for myself, when I disclaim, as I do with all possible earnestness, all connection with those who took part in that triumph, or with those who admire it. When I assert anything regarding the people of England, I speak not from authority, but from my experience of a pretty extensive and mixed communication with the inhabitants of this kingdom, of all kinds and ranks, and after a series of attentive observations begun early in life and continued for nearly 40 years. Considering that we are divided from you only by a slender dike of about 24 miles, and that the two-way contact between the two countries has recently been very great, I have often been astonished to find how little you seem to know of us. I suspect that this is because you form a judgment of this nation from certain publications that represent the opinions and dispositions generally prevalent in England, either very erroneously or not at all. The vanity, restlessness, petulance, and spirit of intrigue of several little cabals, who try to hide their total unimportance in bustle and noise, puffing and mutual quotation of each other, make you think that our contemptuous neglect of their abilities is a mark of general acceptance of their opinions. No such thing, I assure you. Just because half a dozen grasshoppers under a fern make the field ring with their importunate chink, while thousands of cattle lying beneath the shadow of the British oak chew the cud and are silent, don't think that those who make the noise are the only inhabitants of the field, are very numerous, or indeed are anything but the little, shrivelled, meagre, hopping, though loud and troublesome, insects of the hour. I almost venture to affirm that not one in 100 among us shares in the triumph of the Revolution Society. If the King and Queen of France and their children were to fall into our hands by the chance of war, they would be treated with another sort of triumphal entry into London. We have had a King of France in that situation. You have read how John II, after the Battle of Poitiers in 1356, was treated by the victor in the field, and how he was then received in England. 400 years later, we are not significantly changed since that period. Thanks to our sullen resistance to innovation, thanks to the cold sluggishness of our national character, we still bear the stamp of our forefathers. We have not, I think, lost the 14th century's generosity and dignity of thinking, nor have we yet refined ourselves into savages. We are not the converts of Rousseau. We are not the disciples of Voltaire. Helvetius has made no progress among us. Atheists are not our preachers. Madmen are not our lawgivers. We know that we have made no discoveries in morality, and we think that no discoveries are to be made there, nor many in the great principles of government, or in the ideas of liberty, which were understood long before we were born quite as well as they will be after our death. We still feel within us, and we cherish and cultivate, those inbred sentiments that are the faithful guardians and active monitors of our duty, the true supporters of all liberal and manly morals. Why? Because when such ideas are brought before our minds, it is natural to have such feelings. In defence of prejudices. You see, sir, that in this enlightened age, I am bold enough to confess that we are generally men of untaught feelings, that instead of throwing away all our old prejudices, we cherish them, because they are prejudices. And the longer they have lasted, and the more widespread they have been, the more we cherish them. We are afraid to have men try to live and trade each on his own private stock of reason, because we suspect that this stock in each man is small, and that individuals would do better to avail themselves of the general bank and capital of nations and of ages. Many of our thinkers, instead of exploding general prejudices, use their skill to discover the wisdom that lies hidden in them. If they find what they seek, which they usually do, they think it wiser to continue the prejudice with the reason nested in it, than to throw away the coat of prejudice, and to leave nothing but the naked reason. Prejudice is ready for application in an emergency. It has the mind already engaged in a steady course of wisdom and virtue, and doesn't leave the man hesitating, sceptical, puzzled, and unresolved, at the moment of decision. Prejudice makes a man's virtue his habit, and not a series of unconnected acts. Through just prejudice, his duty becomes a part of his nature. Your literary men and your politicians essentially differ in these points, and so do the whole clan of the enlightened among us. They have no respect for the wisdom of others, but they pay it off by a very full measure of confidence in their own. A scheme of things being old is, for them, a sufficient motive to destroy it. As for the new, they have no fears about the duration of a building put up in haste, because duration is not a goal for those who think that little or nothing has been done before their time, and who place all their hopes in discovery. They always speak as if they thought that there is a singular species of contract between them and their magistrates that binds the magistrate but has nothing reciprocal in it. The majesty of the people has a right to dissolve the government without any reason but its will. Their attachment to their country itself is conditional on its agreeing with some of their fleeting projects. It begins and ends with a political scheme that squares with their momentary opinion. These doctrines, or rather these sentiments, seem prevalent with your new statesmen, but they are wholly different from the ones we have always acted on in this country. If anyone tried to push England in the direction France has taken. I hear that it is sometimes said in France that what is going on among you follows the example of England. I beg leave to affirm that hardly anything done with you, what you are doing or the spirit you are doing it in, has originated from the practice or the prevalent opinions of England's people. Let me add that we are as unwilling to learn these lessons from France as we are sure that we never taught them to that nation. The cabals here, who take a sort of share of your transactions, still contain only a handful of people. If by their intrigues, their sermons, their publications, and by a confidence derived from their French connection, they attract considerable numbers into their faction, and then seriously attempt anything here in imitation of what has been done in France, I prophesy that the outcome will be their own early destruction, though causing some trouble to their country along the way. The English people long ago refused to change their law out of respect for the infallibility of popes, and they will not now alter it from a pious implicit faith in the dogmatism of philosophers. Formerly, your affairs were your own concern only. We felt for them as men, but we kept apart from them, because we were not citizens of France. But when we see the model held up to ourselves, we must feel as Englishmen, and feeling in that way we must behave as Englishmen. We did not want this, but our own interests now involve your affairs, at least in having us keep your panacea or plague at a distance. If it is a panacea, we do not want it. We know the results of taking unnecessary medicines. If it is a plague, it is of such a kind that the most severe quarantine ought to be established against it. I hear that a cabal, calling itself philosophic, receives the glory of many of the recent proceedings, and that their opinions and systems are the true actuating spirit of all of them. I have heard of no literary or political party in England known by such a description. Is yours composed of men, whom the vulgar in their blunt, homely style commonly call atheists and infidels? If so, I admit that we too have had writers of that kind, who made some noise in their day. At present they repose in lasting oblivion, and in a few years their few successors will also be buried and forgotten. But whatever they were or are. With us they were and are wholly unconnected individuals. They never acted as a body, or were known as a faction in the state, or presumed under the label free thinkers to influence any of our public concerns. Whether they ought so to exist and be permitted so to act is another question, because such cabals have not existed in England. The cabal spirit had never had any influence in establishing the original structure of our constitution, or in any of the various repairs and improvements it has undergone. Religion as the basis of civil society. We know, and what is better, we feel inwardly, that religion is the basis of civil society, and the source of all good and of all comfort. In England, we are so convinced of this, that there is no rust of superstition, that the accumulated absurdity of the human mind might have crusted religion over, in the course of ages, that 99% of the people of England wouldn't prefer to atheism. We shall never be such fools as to invite an enemy to the substance of any system to remove its corruptions, to fill its gaps, or to complete its construction. If our religious tenets ever need further elucidation, we shall not call on atheism to explain them. Without violently condemning other systems of religion, we prefer the Protestant system, not because we think it has less of the Christian religion in it, but because we think it has more. We are proud to know that man is by his constitution a religious animal, that atheism is against not only our reason but our instincts, and that it cannot prevail long. But if we were to uncover our nakedness by throwing off the Christian religion that has hitherto been our boast and comfort, we fear that some uncouth, pernicious, and degrading superstition might take its place. For that reason, we don't want to deprive our establishment of the natural human means of estimation, and give it up to contempt, as you have done, until we are shown something to put in its place. Then we shall form our judgment. Caution in amending the state. When the people have emptied themselves of all the cravings of selfish will, when they realize that they are exercising power that is legitimate only if it squares with the eternal, immutable law in which will and reason are the same, they will be more careful about putting power into base and incompetent hands. In picking people to exercise authority, they will treat this as though it were appointing them not to a pitiful job, but to a holy function. They won't select according to their sordid, selfish interest, or to their wild whims, or to their arbitrary will. Rather, they will confer that power only on those in whom they can see a predominant proportion of active virtue and wisdom among the great mixed mass of human imperfections and infirmities. When they are habitually convinced that someone whose essence is good will find it unacceptable to do evil or to permit it, they will be better able to sweep out of the minds of all magistrates, civil, ecclesiastical, or military, anything that has the least resemblance to proud and lawless domination. But one of the first and most leading principles on which the Commonwealth and the laws are consecrated is that power holders should not have a right to block the inheriting of property, or to squander their inheritance by destroying the whole original fabric of their society, risking leaving a ruin instead of a habitation to those who come after them. By this unprincipled readiness to change the state as often, as much, and as variously as there are floating fancies or fashions, the whole chain and continuity of the Commonwealth would be broken. No one generation could link with the next. Men would become little better than the flies of a summer. First of all, the science of jurisprudence would be regarded as a heap of old exploded errors, and would be no longer studied. Actually, it is the pride of the human intellect which, with all its defects, redundancies, and errors, is a collected reason of ages, combining the principles of original justice with the infinite variety of human concerns. Personal self-sufficiency and arrogance which are always found in those who have never experienced a wisdom greater than their own, would usurp the tribunal. No certain laws, establishing invariable grounds of hope and fear, would keep men's actions on a certain course, or direct them to a certain goal. Nothing stable in the ways of holding property or exercising functions could form a solid basis on which any parent could think through the education of his offspring, or a choice for their future place in the world. No principles would be early worked into people's habits. As soon as the most able instructor had completed his laborious work, instead of sending forth a pupil fitted to get attention and respect, he would find that he had turned out a poor creature to the contempt and derision of a world that was ignorant of the true grounds of esteem. Who could ensure that a tender and delicate sense of honour would beat almost with the first pulses of the heart, when no man could know what would be the test of honour in a nation continually varying the standard of its coin? No part of life would retain its acquisitions. Barbarism with regard to science and literature, unskilfulness with regard to arts and manufactures, would inevitably follow the lack of a steady education and settled principle. The Commonwealth would eventually crumble away, broken up into the dust and powder of individuality, and at length dispersed to all the winds of heaven. The evils of inconstancy and changeability are 10,000 times worse than those of obstinacy and the blindest prejudice. To avoid them, therefore, we have consecrated the state, so that no man should come close to look into its defects or corruptions except with due caution, that he should never dream of starting to reform it by subverting it, that he should come to the faults of the state as to the wounds of a father, with pious awe and trembling solicitude. Society as a contract. Society is indeed a contract. Subordinate contracts for objects of mere occasional interest may be dissolved at pleasure, but the state ought not to be considered as nothing better than a partnership agreement in a trade of pepper or coffee or the like, to be adopted for a little temporary interest and dissolved at the wish of the parties. It is to be looked on with reverence, because it is not a partnership in temporary and perishable things that are subservient only to our animal existence. It is a partnership in all science, all art, every virtue, and all perfection. The goals of such a partnership can be obtained only over many generations, so it becomes a partnership connecting the living not only with one another, but also with the now dead and the not yet born. The great primeval contract of eternal society is not subject to the will of those who, by an obligation infinitely superior to them, are bound to submit their will to that law. The municipal corporations of that universal kingdom are not morally free to tear apart the bands of their subordinate community, and to dissolve it into an unsocial, uncivil, unconnected chaos of elementary forces. The only thing that can justify a resort to anarchy is the first and supreme necessity, a necessity that is not chosen, but chooses, a necessity that is paramount to deliberation, admitting no discussion and demanding no evidence. This necessity is no exception to the rule, because this necessity is itself also a part of the moral and physical disposition of things to which man must be obedient by consent or force. But if something that is warranted only by necessity is chosen, then the law is broken, nature is disobeyed, and chaos and misery ensue. These, my dear sir, were, and I think, long will be the sentiments of people who are the most learned and reflective part of this kingdom. They form their opinions on such grounds as such persons ought to form them. Less thoughtful people acquire the opinions from an authority that those who have to live on, trust, need not be ashamed to rely on. These two sorts of men move in the same direction, though in a different place. They both move with the order of the universe. they all see themselves as bound to perform their national homage to the institutor and author and protector of civil society, without which civil society man could not come anywhere near the perfection his nature is capable of. They conceive that God, who gave our nature to be perfected by our virtue, willed also the necessary means of its perfection. So he willed the state. He willed its connection with the source and original archetype of all perfection. Those who are convinced of this will of his, which is the law of laws and the sovereign of sovereigns, cannot think it wrong that our praise of the state should be performed as all solemn public acts are performed, in buildings, in music, in decoration, in speech, in the dignity of persons, according to the customs taught to mankind by their nature, that is, with modest splendour and mild majesty. English attitudes. It is on some such principles that the majority of the people of England, far from thinking a national religious establishment unlawful, hardly think it lawful not to have one. If you in France do not believe that we are attached to this above all other things, and beyond all other nations, you are wholly mistaken. And when this people has acted unwisely and unjustifiably in its favour, as sometimes they most certainly have done, their very errors will at least show to you their zeal. This principle runs through their whole political structure. They consider their church establishment not as merely convenient, but as essential to their state, not as something heterogeneous and separable, an add-on that they may keep or lay aside according to their temporary ideas of convenience. They regard it as the foundation of their whole constitution, with which, and with every part of which, it is indissolubly united. Church and state are ideas inseparable in their minds, and scarcely is the one ever mentioned without mentioning the other. Our education is formed in a way that confirms and fixes this impression. Our education is in a way wholly in the hands of ecclesiastics at all stages from infancy to manhood. Even when our youth, leaving schools and universities, enter that most important period of life that begins to link study with experience, and when with that view they visit other countries, they are not accompanied by old domestics, whom we see as governors to principal men from other lands. 3/4 of those who go abroad with our young nobility and gentlemen are ecclesiastics, and they go not as austere masters or mere followers, but as friends and companions of a graver character, and quite often persons as well born as those whose companions they are. They stay closely connected to them through life. We think that by this connection we attach our gentlemen to the church, and we liberalize the church by conversation with the leading characters of the country. We are so tenacious of the old ecclesiastical modes and fashions of institution that very little alteration has been made in them since the 14th century. Adhering in this, as in everything, to our old settled maxim, never entirely or suddenly depart from antiquity, we found these old institutions, on the whole, favourable to morality and discipline, and we thought they could be amended without altering their foundations. We thought they were capable of receiving and improving and, above all, preserving the gains in science and literature, as the order of providence should successively produce them. And after all, with this system of education we may claim that our share in the improvements in science, arts, and literature that have illuminated and adorned the modern world is as large and as early as that of any other nation in Europe. We think one main cause of this improvement was our not despising the patrimony of knowledge left to us by our forefathers. It is because of our attachment to a church establishment that the English nation did not think it wise to entrust that great fundamental interest of the whole to what they don't trust with any part of their civil or military public service, that is, to the unsteady and precarious contribution of individuals. They go further. They never did, and never will, allow the fixed estate of the church to be converted into a pension, to depend on the treasury, and to be delayed, withheld, or perhaps even extinguished by real or supposed fiscal difficulties. The people of England think they have constitutional reasons, as well as religious ones, for rejecting any project of turning their independent clergy into ecclesiastical pensioners of state. So they made their church, like their king and their nobility, independent. From the combined considerations of religion and constitutional policy, from their view about the duty to make sure provision for helping the feeble and instructing the ignorant, they have included the estate of the church in the great mass of private property, of which the state is not the proprietor, but only the guardian and the regulator. They have ordained that the income of this establishment is to be as stable as the earth on which it stands, and should not fluctuate with the to and fro of funds and actions. The men of England, I mean the men who provide light and leadership in England, whose wisdom is open and direct, would be ashamed to profess verbally any religion which by their actions they appear to despise. The Christian statesmen of this land would indeed first provide for the multitude, that being the first objective in the ecclesiastical institution and in all institutions. They have been taught that the Gospels being preached to the poor was one of the great tests of its true mission. So they think that those who do not take care to have it preached to the poor do not believe it. But as they know that charity is not confined to any one kind of person, but ought to apply itself to all people who have wants, they also have a due and anxious pity for the miserable great who are in distress. They are aware that religious instruction matters more to them than to any others, because of the greatness of the temptation they are exposed to, the important consequences that come with their faults, the contagion of the bad example they set, the need to bow down the stubborn neck of their pride and ambition to the yoke of moderation and virtue, the facts about the stupidity and ignorance concerning what men most need to know, stupidity and ignorance that prevail at courts and at the head of armies and in senates as much as at the loom and in the field. The people of England know how little influence the teachers of religion are likely to have on the wealthy and powerful, if they, the teachers, appear to be much lower in social rank than those they must associate with, and sometimes even exercise a kind of authority over. What must the wealthy and powerful think of that body of teachers if they see it at the level of their domestic servants? If their poverty were voluntary, there might be some difference. But the mass of any kind of men are only men, and in most cases their poverty cannot be voluntary. So the disrespect that comes with all lay poverty will also come with ecclesiastical poverty. For these reasons, we have not relegated religion to obscure municipalities or rustic villages. No, we will have her to exalt her mitred front in courts and parliaments. We will have her mixed throughout the whole mass of life, and blended with all the classes of society. The people of England will show to the haughty potentates of the world, and to their talking logical tricksters, that a free, generous, and informed nation honours the high magistrates of its church, that it will not allow the insolence of wealth and titles, or any other kind of proud pretension, to look down with scorn on what they looked up to with reverence. In England, most of us think that when some people look disapprovingly at the distinctions, honours, and revenues that are given as rewards for virtue, they are driven not by love of the self-denial and mortification of the ancient church, but by envy and hostility. The people of England have sharp ears. They hear these men speak in a vulgar and coarse way, their language in the jargon of fraud, in the cant and gibberish of hypocrisy. We shall believe these reformers to be honest extremists, rather than, as we now think them, cheats and deceivers, when we see them putting their own goods into the common pool and submitting their own persons to the austere discipline of the early church. With these ideas rooted in their minds, the Commons of Great Britain will never in national emergencies have recourse to the confiscation of the estates of the church and poor. There is not one public man in this kingdom whom you would wish to quote, who does not condemn the dishonest, perfidious, and cruel confiscation that the National Assembly has been compelled to make of property that it was their first duty to protect. With the pleasure of a little national pride, I tell you that those among us who have wished to drink the health of the societies of Paris with the cup of their abominations have been disappointed. The robbery of your church has proved a security to the possession of ours. That shameless act of proscription has opened our people's eyes to the frame of mind in which insidious men have started in hypocrisy and fraud, and ended in open violence and theft. Seeing beginnings here in England, we are on our guard against similar conclusions. The Confiscators. I hope we shall never be so totally lost to all sense of the duties imposed on us by the law of social union as to use the excuse of public service to confiscate the goods of a single unoffending citizen. Who but a tyrant could think of seizing the property of men unaccused, unheard, untried by hundreds and thousands together? Who, that hadn't lost every trace of humanity, could think of casting down men of exalted rank and sacred function, some of them of an age to call for both reverence and compassion, casting them down from the highest situation in the Commonwealth, where they were maintained by their own landed property, to a state of indigence, depression, and contempt? The confiscators have indeed made some allowance to their victims from the scraps and fragments of their own tables from which they have been so harshly driven. But to drive men from independence to live on alms is itself great cruelty. Persons who were taught to favour religion by their education and by their place in the administration of its functions are to receive the remnants of their property as alms from the profane and irreligious hands of those who had robbed them of all the rest. But this act of seizure of property, it seems, is a judgment in law and not a confiscation. They have, it seems, found out in the academies of the Palais Royal and the Jacobins that certain men had no right to the possessions that they held under law, usage, the decisions of courts, and the accumulated prescription of 1,000 years. They say that ecclesiastics are fictitious persons, creatures of the state, that their possessions are not properly theirs, but belong to the state, which created the fiction, and that we are not to trouble ourselves with what they may suffer in their natural feelings and natural persons on account of what is done to them in this created fiction character. To this I say, what does it matter under what labels you injure men and deprive them of the just emoluments of a profession that they were not only permitted but encouraged by the state to engage in? Emoluments whose supposed certainty was the basis on which they had formed the plan of their lives, contracted debts, and led multitudes to an entire dependence on them. I shan't compliment this miserable distinction between the fictional official and the natural man with any long discussion. Tyranny's arguments are as contemptible as its forces dreadful. If your confiscators had not by their early crimes obtained a power that gives them indemnity for all their later crimes, their logical trick that became an accomplice of theft and murder would have been refuted, not by the syllogism of the logician, but by the lash of the executioner. This outrage on all the rights of property was at first covered astonishingly by a concern for national credit. The enemies of property at first claimed to have a most tender, delicate, and scrupulous anxiety for paying the king's debts to creditors other than private citizens. If these professors of the rights of men were not so busy teaching others, they might have had time in which to learn that the first and original credit of civil society is pledged to the property of the citizen, and not to the demands of the creditor of the state. The claim of the citizen is prior in time, paramount in title, superior in equity. the fortunes of individuals, whether possessed by acquisition or by descent, or in virtue of a participation in the goods of some community, were no part of the collateral for the creditor's loan. They never entered his head when he made his bargain. He well knew that the public, whether represented by a monarch or by a senate, can pledge nothing but the public estate, and it can have no public estate except in what it derives from a just and proportioned tax on the citizens at large. This was engaged, and nothing else could be engaged, to the public creditor. End of the first one-third of part 2.